Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. Before we call our first case, I'm going to welcome several students who are here with us today. We have Rufus King, and is it, tell me the name of the high school. Rufus King, is it 1B High School? What? Ah, that's what IB stands for, International Baccalaureate. Well, that's wonderful. Would those students, whatever the name of that high school is, please stand? Good. Well, we're delighted to welcome you here with us this morning. Won't you be seated? We also have Heritage Christian School. Would those students please stand? And we're delighted to welcome you here this morning. Please be seated. The students are here today with the Court with Class program that is sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. This is a national award-winning program in which the students are invited to come and hear oral argument. They've been given the briefs of the case, and they might have been given other materials and had people come and talk about the case to them and with them. And then at noon, they will meet with a justice of this court, and everyone is cordially invited to attend that session. There will be no discussion of the substance of this case that you're about to hear, but the procedures that the court uses in hearing and deciding cases. We've met the students. I want to introduce the court to the students, and I'll start on my far left with Justice Patience Rogensack. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. Justice Prosser is the justice who will meet with you today at lunch. My immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Diane Sykes. I should tell you that at noon you will be joined with more students from Rufus King and from students from the Richard School District. So, I will now call our first case, which is 02-3063W, Custodian of Records for the Legislative Technology Services Bureau versus the State of Wisconsin. Peter Dykeman is arguing on behalf of the Legislative Technology Services Bureau. Mr. Alan Lee, Assistant Attorney General, will argue for the State of Wisconsin. Robert E. Hankel will argue for Judge O'Brien, and then 5 minutes for you, Mr. Dykeman, in rebuttal. You may proceed.
May it please the Court, I am Peter Dykeman, General Counsel of the Legislative Reference Bureau. With me is my co-counsel, Michael Rigg, of the Legislative Technology Services Bureau. We are nonpartisan legislative attorneys representing the custodian records of the nonpartisan Legislative Technology Services Bureau. In August 2002, the custodian of records of the Legislative Technology Services Bureau, LTSB, received a very broad, very secret subpoena issued by a John Doe judge on behalf of the prosecution seeking legislative data. LTSB, as the legislature's internal information technology service agency, is required to at all times observe the confidential nature of the electronic data it maintains for the legislature. The custodian reacted to the subpoena by filing a motion to quash the subpoena on statutory and constitutional grounds. The John Doe judge denied the motion and ordered the custodian to produce all LTSB-created emergency backup tapes from December 15, 2001. The tapes contain a snapshot of most all of the data possessed on computers by all members and employees in the entire legislative branch that existed at the moment the hard drives on the servers were copied onto tape. The issue before the court today is whether one branch of government can seize data from the inner sanctums of the other branches. The legislature has set forth a procedure by which the data of a legislature, of legislator may be obtained. Requests for a legislator's data must be directed to the legislator, not to the LTSB. In this case, the prosecution has failed to follow the legislature's procedure. We are here to ask this court to require the prosecution to respect the procedures of the legislature and to order the John Doe judge to quash the subpoena issued to the custodian. This one issue has five prongs, as we set out in our brief.
Counsel, again, can you tell me what the one issue is?
The issue is, can any branch go into the inner sanctums of the other branches and violate the core functions by doing so? It applies whether it's the legislative branch coming to the judiciary or the executive coming to the judiciary or any other branch in this situation. The five prongs really are all interrelated and all should be considered before deciding on which prong. As we start off in our brief, the legislature has created 1396 of the statutes. It prohibits subpoenas to LTSB for legislative data. On its face, 1396 prohibits subpoenas to the LTSB for legislative data. The statute says at all times, observe the confidential nature of the data and information originated, maintained, and processed. All times equals no exceptions. Observe, defined guard, watch, keep, obey, or to abide by. And confidential, marked by intimacy or willingness to confide. Private, secret, entrusted with the confidence of another or with his secret affairs or purposes. Intended to be held in confidence or kept secret, not to be disclosed. So it is, yes.
That section wouldn't counter a search warrant, would it?
I believe it would. I think that it says at all times, observe the confidential nature of the data. It doesn't have an exception for search warrants or for subpoenas. There are many other statutes out there that have a lot of exceptions, but this one has none. It's one of the very few that has no exceptions. But I believe it would, yes.
Let me ask you, emails, the electronic records that seem to be the subject of this subpoena, are those public records?
Not necessarily. I believe that some of them are records. They're all owned by the legislator, not by LTSB. 1396 is a block to open records as well as to subpoenas and search warrants. It really is irrelevant. All it says is that this privilege is absolute as to the data in the hands of LTSB. It doesn't answer the question about whether it is confidential or privilege in the hands of the owner, namely the legislator. The issue is that the legislature has established this procedure and it's directed that the everybody else has to go to the member who owns the record. And it really doesn't matter.
Where does it say that?
It says that in a whole series of things. It starts in 1396, but if you also look in 1391 through 1396, five of the six service agencies have this confidential at all times. So on the face of it, it says it, but it also teams up with 90501 intro to create a privilege. 90501 intro is the vehicle by which all privileges are created. And if you look at the two together, 90501 intro says, except as provided by or inherent or implicit in statute. And if you look at it, the whole system, 1391 to 1396, 1933, that says that the member is the custodian and the owner of the records, 90501 intro is just the statutory basis, but this all relates also to Article 4, Section 8. All of them work together. They create a unified statement that if you want to get legislators' records, you have to go to the member, not to the service agency. And this is what the Reference Bureau has been saying about the drafts that it has prepared for legislators over the years. I've been there 30 years, and we just say you can't get it from us if it's not introduced, but you can maybe be able to get it from the custodian, namely the member.
Mr. Dykeman, several minutes ago you mentioned backup tapes, and I've got a question in regard to the backup tapes that are subject to this subpoena. How far back do they go in terms of time?
The backup tape, what happens is that the servers at the LTSB are the members' hard drives, except for the C drive that's in their office. So it's networked, belongs to them. And that is on the servers. The tapes back up pretty much nightly and make a set of tapes that are a snapshot of the member's hard drive. It's a snapshot of all the information is there. It includes whatever I had on my server over there, as well as the members.
Oh,
it goes. It takes. It is whatever is on the hard drives on December 15th, 2001.
Okay. Do they go back beyond December 15th, 2001?
No. It's a snapshot, and the information is everything that is there on that date. And it contains material. I know that I have memos on mine going back to the 70s and 80s. It is whatever is on my hard drive, the Y drive or the S drive over at the Legislative Technology Service Bureau.
Okay, so the answer to my question is that you have material there that goes back to the 70s and 80s?
Yes, we do.
Would that be true for other legislators?
Well, if they would be true for any legislator that was a legislator ever since 1970, but it would be whatever they retained.
Take Marlon Schneider as an example.
Right.
Would a lot of his material going back as long as he's been in the legislature be?
This system was created in 1994, so we know that anything since then is definitely there. Now, there was a restoration from the old system, the computer system, to the new system when the changeover was there. So anything that the member asked to have moved over was moved over. So I don't know what the individual members are. I've never seen these tapes. I don't know what exactly, specifically are on them, but I know I kept my memos and my that I wanted to keep going way back, and the Legislative Reference Bureau kept unintroduced drafts from way back, and I spent months in the conversion in 94 moving and making sure we moved over the things that we needed the most to retain in 1994.
Counsel, I'm interested in continuing with that area of inquiry. I note that the order indicates, and I'm talking about the order of November 2nd or November 4th, indicates that there should be production, that is, that you produce either all December 15th, 2002 backup tapes and deliver them to the judge's chambers, or extract the subpoenaed records as modified on November 1 and deliver that to the John Doe chambers for in-camera inspection. So what is it's being requested are all the tapes that are December 15th, 2002 backup tapes?
201, yes, Your Honor.
Is it 201?
Yes, it's yep. December 15th, 2001.
Thank
2001.
You.
And on that is a terabyte of information. We think that if we started a printer in this room and played it all out, it would fill this room floor to ceiling, wall to wall, and spill out into the hall.
What's the purpose of backup tapes?
The purpose of, until we get a subpoena or an open record request, They're on a 28-day cycle. They get taped over. What the purpose of them are is that if a member hard drive breaks or one of the servers breaks, it's an emergency situation.
You can retrieve that information.
Right.
And that's why we. That's why I'm always, when I'm doing things, when I'm writing an opinion, so I can back up, so
right.
I can retrieve.
Right.
Even if I, lose that precious stuff that I'm writing.
Right.
So if the whole purpose of the tapes is to retrieve them, it seems as though you're painting this incredibly arduous task that's insurmountable, that defeats the very purpose.
Your Honor, it's not insurmountable, but to go through all the records, as I described, which we say in our briefs, hundreds of millions of pages, we may have been wrong by a factor of 10. It may have filled up the assembly chambers fully. I don't know.
Why don't you just give them, I agree, that would be a problem. Just give them, as the order says, to the John Doe judge and let the John Doe judge do it.
What? That's a violation of 1396 and Article 4, Section 8. The custodian
would...
It
isn't so much that you're fighting about the scope, because you can turn everything over, all these rooms full of stuff, to her, to the John Doe judge. But it's really, it's the... statute and the privilege that you're asserting, that's the essence of it.
Yes.
Not the hassle, because you can turn the hassle over to someone else.
Well, our final prong that deals with the hassle. It would take a long time, but that's the final thing. And I don't think the court reaches that issue, as you're saying.
What is the authority that you would cite to indicate that any privilege is absolute?
The judicial privilege is absolute. This, while much narrower, is absolute. The privilege for the whole legislature is not absolute.
Well, let's take a look at 905. You've got attorney-client privilege. Is that absolute?
No.
Is work product absolute?
No.
Psychologist-client privilege absolute?
I don't think so.
Medical records absolute. They all
have it. The medical records is in the statutes, and one of them has 22 exceptions. Built in by the legislature. Other ones have no exceptions.
Okay, so what I'm trying to find, because and looking at Blinka, as I often do, I can't find any authority for any privilege being absolute. So I need your assistance to cite authority for
my what? Understanding is the judicial privilege is absolute, no exceptions, and it's not even in the statutes.
If a judge, and what do you mean by judicial
privilege? Well, if a judge, let's say Judge O'Brien is held to, as we say, to have violated the Constitution and the statutes in issuing the subpoena and trying to enforce it, she's privileged in that decision.
That's immunity. Privilege. That's not privilege. I mean, privilege deals with evidentiary production or evidentiary testifying. It doesn't deal with...
The 905...
She's not privileged from the decision. She's immune.
I have no problem saying that 1396 would be immunity, but what it is a very... 90501 has a statement that says, except as provided by or inherent or implicit in statute, and under Burnett v. Ault, which was very implicit, the court says... I think that should be the fence in the ballpark. I would hope it wouldn't go beyond that. But there is a statute. This is the statute by the legislature by law, and the Supreme Court by Supreme Court rule creates privileges, and it does not require the use of the word privilege. Burnett v. Ault is cited for that exact proposition. There are many situations out there where privileges are created by statute. There's maybe hundreds. Most of the things that you mentioned that are in Chapter 905 are the broad, general ones that have exceptions.
Other than your response regarding judicial privilege that you just gave, can you cite to any authority that any other privilege is absolute, if indeed judicial privilege is absolute? Can you give me authority for any privilege being absolute?
The notes of the Judicial Council to 90501 in their creation back in 73 talk about privileges, also about Blinka that we cite talks about the privileges being sprinkled throughout the statutes being narrow, which I agree, but on their face they are absolute.
When you say narrow, you mean they're to be construed narrowly because they're in the interpretation of common law?
No, because I think that the ones in 905 are pretty broad and pretty general. This is a very specific, very general statute. It says, don't come to LTSB for this material. It belongs to the legislator. Go to the legislator. It isn't broad in the sense that it covers the whole legislative branch. It covers only LTSB. It's the procedure that Article 4, Section 8 has established and says go to the member. Statutes all say that, and it says that, and there's no exceptions on its face. If you look out and take it broader, it teams up with 90501 intro. Even broader, you look at Article 4, Section 8, it's even broader. It's the process where the legislature demands that anybody getting the legislator's records go to the legislator, not to a backdoor subpoena where my client cannot tell the member that he's being subpoenaed and cannot be involved and not even can't even exercise any constitutional rights, takes the rights away from the legislators.
Counselor, if you were forced to give these documents up as a subpoena request, do you know of any privileges that the individual legislators might raise that they wouldn't have the opportunity to raise because you're being asked rather than they're being asked?
Yes. Article 4, Section 16, the speech or debate, is being taken away, trying to be taken away by this secrecy of the subpoena. I don't see how, one hand, the judge can subpoena my client and then deny my client the right to either argue for the legislator or let the legislature decide this. And that's certainly a privilege. There are other privileges in the statutes like HIV information. I believe there's that, you know, in answer to Justice Bradley's question, going through everything. I mean, I believe my client, if we were forced to do so, would have to go through and strip out everything about conversations of legislators and constituents about HIV. There's other types of things throughout the statute that have to be discussed. And so it, you know, it really is, if you ever get to that point, it really is a serious problem.
Okay, can't the judge do that in camera?
As soon as the judge gets it, the custodian has violated 1396, Your Honor, and Article 4, Section 8. The legislature has established the procedure, and it is not for anybody else to say that they cannot do so. They have the authority under the Constitution, and they have done so.
If we really agree with your argument, although you carefully state it in terms of only your entity, not the individual legislator, but if we agree with that, they really do all apply to the legislator because you view yourself as an aide to the legislature.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you view yourself as having the rights of the legislature in addition to your own rights.
My client has the right, we believe, and we believe this court should so find, that my client has the right to exercise Article 4, Section 16 rights on behalf of every legislator mentioned in the subpoena, at least until the custodian can talk to the members and is not foreclosed from doing so by the secrecy order. As to the application, five of the six service agencies have this confidential at all time language, not the reviser, because they don't have any legislators' material. And
I understand that. And I have another question for you. You were starting to say that your backup tapes run on a 28-day cycle.
Yes.
And then, therefore, on the 29th day, you start reusing that backup tape.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you don't have a backup tape for December 2001 because it's already been erased.
Oh, the tapes for December 15th, 2001 are in a lockbox. But that's not normal procedure.
Why are they in a lockbox?
Because there was an open records request in the subpoena, and we're not going to destroy.
As of what date was there an open record and subpoena request?
Before the 28 days.
Okay. So you've got that.
And right.
And thereafter.
That issue wasn't decided, and we have to keep it for 60 days under open records, and we have to keep it on, and by the time a subpoena comes down, we're not going to destroy it.
What I'm trying to figure out is, let me raise it to you this way. Just you complain that this subpoena is too broad, et cetera, you don't understand it. Tell me what you think this subpoena asks for.
In one hand, it says, give me the hard drives of all legislators and legislative staff.
That you have.
That we have. And if you don't want to do that, go through all this data and give us the records, the information and data specified in the subpoena for the people mentioned in the subpoena.
Now, there are two or more persons who, legislators who are specific.
There's two or more legislators and two or more aides, and there may be others, I don't know, and there's two or more types of information.
And from what date to what date?
It's a snapshot of December 15, 2001, whatever was on the members and aides' servers. So it would include whatever I had on my server over at LTSB, which some of my memos are from the 70s and 80s. I don't know the specifics for everybody else.
All right. So they may or may not do that. All right. Now, did you have an opportunity before the John Doe judge, to decide to argue that it was that there is too much information for too long a time, and that there's a lot of not relevant to the charge of the John Doe proceeding? You know what the judge?
Yes, not necessarily. We have been kept in the dark on most things, but for the purpose of this argument, we have every information we need. We had that opportunity, and that is, I believe, is why the order was produced, the tapes totally, or go through this process. And in 2 weeks, it's impossible to do it. And it might be impossible to do it fully, depending on what I've heard of technology backing it up. You may not get everything, but the process would have taken months to complete.
So if a legislator asked you for what he or she has as of December 15, 2001, would you comply with that request?
Yes, and that's the example. One of the best examples is legislators have Palm Pilots, and they go home and they check their email and whatever else, and they delete everything after they've read it, and then they come back to the office and they synchronize it. And that means you wipe it off.
Right.
Okay, well, one office, I've been told, did it 4 times, and my client still smiled and tried to replace it. 4 times in one session, that person did it. And they do try to do it. They can't necessarily get 100% back, but they can try. They can try, and they will try.
Why can't you try for the judge?
Because the
assuming there's no privilege, I'm just getting at, is it possible? Is it harassment? Is it oppressive? Do you understand the relevancy?
Yeah, it is going through that much data is the broadest subpoena I've ever heard about in our research.
So how would you narrow the subpoena?
I would quash it rather than narrow it, to narrow it, I would say that you'd specify the exact type of documents, not just everything, the precise people. Would need to talk to the chief clerk to know who was employed by certain people at certain times. One of the real problems with this is the tapes don't back up people. They back up computers. And it's the hard drive. And a person, there's multiple people necessarily working on one hard drive. And the S drive is definitely a shared drive. quite often the Y drives are shared also by sharing different information, and different offices have it. So what happens is that you cannot say that so-and-so entered that. You don't know that so-and-so entered it. And
no, it came from Z's office, or it's X's office.
No, you don't. That's the problem. It could have been a laptop in the back home, in the home office. It could have been anybody. It could have been anybody walking to the office. It could have been just about anybody that has access to it. And it's most likely to be somebody from that office. But it's not necessarily on that type of thing.
Well, Mr. Dykeman, your time is up. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Are there any other questions at this time? All right. Thank you. We'll now hear from Assistant Attorney General Lee, representing the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Lee?
May it please the Court, I am Alan Lee, an Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. Legislative functions and prerogatives are protected from encroachment by the other branches, by the Constitution, by the privilege in speech and debate, by the rules of proceedings, and by the doctrine of separation of powers. The statute, section 13.96, which we've heard so much about, does not, and I submit cannot, expand on those constitutional protections. It does not expand on the constitutional protections because on its face, it creates no privilege and does not make any non-confidential document confidential. It merely commands Bureau staff to maintain and observe the confidentiality of their work. The statute cannot be interpreted as adding to the constitutional protections because that interpretation would make the statute unconstitutional.
Counselor, you said that the protections for encroachments of one branch of government as to another come from the Constitution, and then you go to the statute and you say, this statute doesn't do it because it doesn't set out a privilege. What if the statute does set out a privilege? Then how does that square with your base argument that only those encroachments can be provided for in the Constitution?
That is exactly the point I was just going to make, Justice Rogensack, that if the statute is interpreted as the petitioners would ask the court to interpret it, I submit it would be unconstitutional if it is interpreted as creating a privilege, because it would be nothing more or nothing less than one branch of government unilaterally trying to insulate itself from the checks and balances of the other branches. It would be a unilateral extension, as it were, of constitutional privilege. The petitioners have suggested that the records that have been subpoenaed could be obtained from the legislators themselves. That's true. Some of them could, for all we know, some of them have been. The problem there is, there are multiple problems with that, but one of them is the subpoena also includes caucus staff memos. Legislators might not have those. Probably many of them would not have those. And it's an obvious source of investigative inquiry to see what kind of memos were going among caucus staff in each of the caucuses.
Are those persons identifiable? That came from me, Mr.
Yes. They're identifiable in the sense that some of them would have memos that would have names on them. Whether the person's name on the memo is the person who actually did it is going to be a proof problem for the prosecutors down the road.
Right, but it's possible for the prosecution to identify those persons whose emails it's interested in and for what time period and craft a subpoena that would target that. That's possible, isn't it?
They could target a much more narrow time period, yes, but as the colloquy, I think, among the judge, prosecutor, and Mr. Dykeman showed, the prosecution, the investigators, and the judge are interested in doing that. The investigators have no interest, and I would think the judge has no interest in the assembly chambers full of documents.
Well, then why didn't they narrow it in this case?
Because
why did they ask for the entire electronic filing cabinet?
Because that is the document that exists that can be subpoenaed. Within that are documents that the prosecutors would have no interest in whatsoever, old documents, things that have nothing whatsoever to do with it. But
so you're conceding it's overbroad.
That's where they have to start. That's where they have to start.
Why?
Because there may well not be any other source for those documents.
Well, has it been tried? Have other sources been attempted that are narrower? It seems to me that the state is conceding that this subpoena on its face is overbroad.
No, not necessarily overbroad, because with the petitioner's assistance in identifying documents and identifying procedures, the state is very willing to limit the subpoena. But that is the document that is there that can be subpoenaed, that is extant. There's nothing else that we can ask for and describe with any kind of precision whatsoever.
You can't direct a subpoena to a specific legislator or to a specific caucus staffer asking for all emails from this state to this state.
We could certainly direct a subpoena to a legislator. Some caucus staff and some legislators back from that time probably are no longer there. Sometimes the memos would not necessarily show who had written them and might contain interesting information for the investigation. Those are the kind of things that certainly, once the tapes are provided, would be the logical first cut. But until the tapes, until anybody sees what's there, what's available, it is impossible to describe with any precision what exactly you want. That's the nature of an investigation. You don't necessarily know what's there.
My question has to go with the argument that opposing counsel made of the technological difficulties. I know we're going to have to get beyond the legal, whether it's privilege or whether it's...
Yes.
Okay. But just in your mind's eye, it seems to me when I read the subpoena, which is on page 114, it's extremely broad. You've had other questions about that, and it covers literally, as I view it, according to opposing counsel, we're talking about hundreds of people.
Well,
and hundreds of computers. And the concern that I have is that if there are, we're not asking you to fish or cut bait, but it seems to me if there's some fishing being done here in the sense that this is so broad, that opposing counsel indicates it may take months for even his staff to go through, and if we turn it over, and if it goes to the judge, I can't imagine how anyone's going to go through that within a reasonable amount of time.
The subpoena has already been offered to be limited to certain named legislators and the two caucus staffs.
Named caucus staff?
No, just the caucus records. It would be very difficult to name the caucus staff because we're looking at a stretch of time where you wouldn't not necessarily know who was employed there. So it has been narrowed already. And I think that was possible because, as the custodian has indicated, he told the judge that, yes, we can go in and look for individual records. At the time of the original subpoena, the investigators would not have known if that was possible or not.
You can see that the legislators whose electronic documents are on these backup tapes in this electronic filing cabinet might have an arguable claim of privilege?
They may have in some specific documents.
And how can they possibly assert that claim of privilege
in the
current posture of the subpoena?
If the documents are ever going to be used, they would have an opportunity to exercise that privilege.
Don't they have a privilege to block their acquisition?
I do not think so, no.
If
they have a privilege to block their acquisition, then the legislature has put itself above the law. Then the other branches of government cannot investigate legislative corruption, that simply.
Counsel.
There is no legislative privilege against providing records. In fact, the legislature has said their records are public. They're presumptively open.
I want to focus on what the procedural posture is here today. As I understand it, what is currently before the court is not whether or not records should be turned over to the prosecutor, but whether records should be turned over to the court for in-camera inspection.
To the John Doe judge, yes. That is absolutely correct.
John Doe Judge.
That is correct.
Right. And so to me, that's a very different procedural posture. I mean, as a circuit court judge, I would have in-camera inspections in a variety of instances, mental health records, informant information, release of law enforcement records, all of these things. The judge sits in camera, as provided for in some of the statutory privilege discussions and exceptions, and then decides, I suppose, with decides what is relevant and what is not, and what is privileged, and if there's an exception to the privilege. That's how I would envision it. What input does the individual legislator, would the individual legislator have in that in-camera proceeding, given that the November 4th order says without further involvement of the respondent?
The LTSB, correct. Mm-hmm. The individual legislator would not have involvement in that process any more than anybody in an ordinary in-camera inspection would have some involvement in that process. That is what the judge does. And relying on that, then she would send it on to the prosecution if she determined something was relevant and non-privileged. And if it were never used in any prosecution, there is absolutely no infringement whatsoever on any legislative prerogative. I think that's
it seems to me a little unfair. Citing fairness is my authority, that an individual individual legislator who might have a argument to make about, number one, if it's privileged, number two, whether or not it should be released, even if it is privileged, it seems to me that maybe there should be some input. And so I want you to respond to that.
First of all, these are not being released in any sense of public release. They are going initially to the judge and then maybe to the investigators. And also, I think it's easy to lose sight of the fact that the rules of proceedings, the privilege against speech and debate, separation of powers doctrine exist to protect legislative process and legislative prerogatives, not individual legislators. I think the court made that very clear in its decision in State versus Bino, that it's a very different situation when you're looking at wrongdoing of individual legislators. If an individual legislator can claim a rule of proceeding privilege or a speech and debate privilege against providing records pursuant to a subpoena, they can effectively insulate themselves from oversight by the judicial branch and the executive branch. There's no doubt about that.
See, you're adding to my confusion. You don't want to either.
No, I don't.
And you keep on saying providing records subject to, pursuant to the subpoena. As I see the posture right now before us, is the question is whether or not it's going to be provided records to a judge for an in-camera inspection. That's the posture.
And that's what I mean by
whether or not the records are going to be provided pursuant to a subpoena per se. I mean, and the reason I make that point is we get to the whole separation of powers argument. And the separation of powers argument has been made the executive versus the legislative. I mean, I think there's, as it currently stands, it's legislative versus the judicial. Does a judge have a power? Does the judiciary have the power to order an in-camera inspection of these records?
I agree that's the issue. And when I say pursuant to the subpoena, my understanding of the posture of that subpoena is that the records will be given to the John Doe judge for inspection before anything will be turned over. That's clear from the record. That kind of procedure is exactly what was used in U.S. versus Nixon, in Rostenkowski, in all the other federal cases involving claims of privilege under speech and debate or rules of proceedings. There can be no other solution, because the only other answer is that legislators do not have to provide their records to anyone.
Except in those cases, the targets were able to assert their privilege because they were a party to the subpoena, and that's not the case here.
That's because those were actual prosecutions, and there's a difference between a prosecution and an investigation. The question, for example, changed United States versus Nixon slightly. Instead of former President Nixon raising executive privilege in the context of that demand for information in the trial, what if a grand jury had subpoenaed those same tapes? I suspect, I think there is no doubt about that, the answer had to have been the same.
But in that same situation, the target of the subpoena would be able to assert the privilege in the district court on a motion to quash.
But there is no particular target of this subpoena.
Well, of course there is.
Well, it's been narrowed. But
the subpoena articulates the identities of several legislators and
under John Doe, the subject of the subpoena can come in and move to quash. The custodian has moved to quash. But it's not unusual to ask for records from employers, from banks, from other third parties. That doesn't mean that the person who is ultimately the potential subject of the John Doe has a right to come in and argue that he or she should not be investigated.
What is the legal standard that governs the issuance of this subpoena?
Oh, I think reasonably...
I don't see that we have a subpoena application in the record here, nor do we have a transcript if it was an oral application.
I suspect it's similar to the civil standard on discovery, that it's just reasonably calculated to lead to relevant information.
Where does that come from?
I think that's relatively probably a poor statement, but the statement of the civil standard on discovery.
Well, okay, let me ask it a different way. What is the legal standard that the prosecutor and the John Doe judge used in the issuance of this subpoena?
I don't know.
Well, how can we evaluate its validity if we don't know that?
Well, I think the subpoena on its face is valid. There's no claim here that it is beyond the scope of the John Doe.
Well, regardless of whether we recognize a privilege in this case, don't we have to, at least to get to the fallback argument of overbreath, have to evaluate the legal basis for the issuance of the subpoena as against the breadth of it?
The court
that go along with any motion to
in past cases has said that a subject of a subpoena can challenge the subpoena as being beyond the scope of the John Doe. That hasn't been done here. There's no challenge to this being beyond the scope of the John Doe.
But we do have an overbreath challenge here, and that requires a balancing of the prosecution's need for the documents, the specificity of the subpoena, the relevancy, the admissibility, etc., under State versus Washington and U.S. v. Nixon, as against the claim of overbreath.
Yes.
So how can we do that if we don't know what the legal basis was?
Well, I think, first of all, you look at what the John Doe is investigating, and then you look at what records are being requested and determine whether it is likely that some of those records might have information that is relevant to that investigation.
Isn't the prosecutor required to make a showing as a threshold matter for the issuance of any subpoena, regardless of whether it's in a John Doe or otherwise?
I think not, other than general relevancy.
What's the authority for that? The prosecutor can get any subpoena issued that
state
he or she wants to.
I think state, if it's relevant to that investigation, yes.
No probable cause?
No.
No specificity?
No. Well, specificity would be a problem if it is too broad, yes.
Okay, so some level of specificity is required.
Yes.
But something less than probable cause?
Yes.
Mere relevancy?
I think... reasonably calculated to lead to the discovery of relevant evidence, yes.
Okay, and I think you were about to tell me what the authority for your position on that was when I interrupted.
Oh, I think that is the discovery standard in civil cases.
Case stands for the proposition that we use civil
I don't think there
discovery.
Is such a case.
Okay, this is a criminal investigation,
yes.
Is it not? So why would we not use 968-135, which governs the issuance of subpoenas in criminal investigations? Which requires probable cause.
968-135 is a very specific statute to third parties. And
this is a third-party subpoena, is it not?
Not necessarily, no.
Well, you don't have the targets. You're attempting to get the documents not from the targets, but from through the back door.
We're trying to get the custodian of the records of that body to provide the records.
Well, the legislators are the custodians by statute,
well,
are they not?
Legislators are custodians of their own records, not
right.
necessarily of the legislature's records.
Well, you're trying to get the keeper of the electronic filing cabinet, as I read
yes.
this, to divulge a massive quantity of electronic documents.
We would hope not massive.
Well, I think everyone concedes that at the moment it's a massive request.
That's four legislators in the two caucuses.
Which entails millions of, I don't know, gigabytes or terabytes or whatever the proper computer technology or terminology is.
Not necessarily when you constrain it with dates.
But are the dates constrained here? He says the date is December 2001, no. but that includes documents that
right.
some might date back to the 70s.
But when you subpoena the backup tape of December 15, 2001, you do not necessarily know what's going to be on there. Once you determine that, you can say we don't want anything beyond earlier than 2000, for example. You
well,
can make that cut very easily.
We know, though, that it contains everything on every network member's hard drive on that date.
Yes.
Which likely is millions of
right.
items of data.
But the judge and the investigators have already said they're not interested in all of that.
Well, then why don't they narrow the subpoena and address it to the persons that they're interested in?
Because you do not necessarily know if you will get all of the information. I think a competent, effective investigation has to go and look at multiple sources of records. Otherwise, you are left with one person telling you, these are all the records I have. I don't think any criminal investigator has to take that person at his or her word. If the executive and judicial branch are going to do their jobs, are going to do an effective job of investigating potential corruption in the legislature, they have to be able to look at legislative records. It's that simple.
Mr. Lee, would you defend the validity of the original subpoena?
Yes, because it is very often necessary to issue subpoenas like that in order to freeze something in time and then talk about what is actually doable. Until the record custodian comes back after receiving the subpoena and tells you, I have a problem with this, the investigators don't necessarily know there's a problem. That's not unusual in investigations. You ask for something you think is a reasonable request, and the subject of the subpoena comes back and says, here's why it's not reasonable. And those kind of things are negotiated all the time.
Mr. Dykeman has characterized at least the original subpoena as requiring tapes, disks, with all kinds of information on virtually every member of the legislature, and including a lot of clearly privileged material. Would you disagree with that?
I don't know if there's anything in there that is clearly privileged. I suppose if there's some attorney-client, some medical records, that sort of thing would be privileged. But let's look at what the legislature does. It operates in the open. It bill drafts and has hearings in public, and they have debates in public, and they vote in public, and they discuss things in public. It is, the of the three branches, perhaps the most public.
Well, let me ask this. By the issuance of a subpoena or an order of, maybe not a subpoena, but an order of some kind, could the technology services bureau been ordered to tap the telephones of all the...
No.
How is that different?
There's a specific statute on who can tap telephones. Very specific statute on that.
I'm sorry, what?
There's a very specific statute on who can tap a telephone, and the prosecution would have to go through court to get a wiretap.
Well, but I get what I'm really trying to get at is, does the Fourth Amendment stop at telephones, or does it apply to all of the conversations of all the legislators?
I don't think there's necessarily a Fourth Amendment right of a legislator, no. Not
don't have a Fourth Amendment right?
Excuse me, I couldn't hear you.
Legislators don't have any Fourth Amendment right?
Not in those records, no. If they're going to be used, they may very well have a Fourth Amendment.
Why do they have Fourth Amendment rights in their telephone calls?
Because there's very specific statutes and Fourth Amendment on telephone conversations.
Wait a minute. You just said that the legislature couldn't expand through legislation privileges.
Correct.
Okay. But there's a statute that applies for telephonic interceptions.
For everyone, yes.
Why doesn't the Fourth Amendment apply equally to all these electronic communications that aren't telephone calls?
Well, these are not necessarily covered within the wiretap statute. There's an, I think, open question that's been debated back and forth on the extent of the federal wiretap statute and email. It certainly isn't an answer, hasn't been answered in this state. And I suggest if these documents, as it were in a filing cabinet, the same analysis has to apply. Because, as I have said, if these records are somehow unobtainable simply because of where they are, then the judicial and executive branches cannot perform their constitutional functions.
Well, let me ask this. Suppose the district attorney suspected you of something. Could the district attorney subpoena all the records of the Department of Justice in order to get your emails?
I think there may be a question of subpoenaing all of those records. I think it would be limited to those records that could reasonably be calculated to show what I was doing, the potential wrongdoing they were investigating that I was doing. But yes, they could.
And if the district attorney were investigating me, could all of the records of all of the justices, all of the emails and all of the word and everything be subpoenaed?
A much more difficult issue. Because of the common law privilege, essentially, in the deliberative process of the court. But ultimately, the answer has to be yes. Somebody has to be able to investigate. Now, there may be greater safeguards that are necessary, but ultimately, the answer has to be yes. Because otherwise, as the court said in Rostenkowski and other cases, if that is not the answer, then legislators have put themselves above the law. It's that simple.
Well, are you saying that the courts have more privileges than the legislature?
I am suggesting that more of what the court does is privileged than the legislature. Now, the legislature, as I said, might very well have some privilege in some of these documents. Might very well be some privileged documents there. My point about the court is that the court's functions are necessarily confidential. If, for example, the subpoena was only asking for records of your hearings on administrative matters that you do in the open, that would be a very different analysis than asking for records of deliberations or memos that involve cases. Does a privilege apply? Yes. A legislative privilege might apply. A judicial privilege might apply. Does that mean the records can't be subpoenaed? It cannot mean that. If it means that, then the legislature has put itself above the law.
Mr. Lee, you've lost me. Let's say that there was a subpoena to CCAP, which is our equivalent technological agency, and you asked for all the backup tapes that CCAP has, which would clearly include drafts of opinions, emails back and forth among the justices. All of that would go if we accept what you're saying. It would go to the John Doe judge. Is that not correct?
Correct. Now, as a practical matter, what usually happens is those investigations are done by federal authorities and they go to the grand jury judge.
What's the difference?
None.
But if we accept your argument, that's exactly what could happen to the judicial branch of government.
Yes. If there were an investigation going into possible corruption in the judiciary, those records would have to be obtainable. There's no doubt about that. Now, would that cause problems? Yes, it would cause problems, just like this one has caused problems.
You don't think the grand jury judge would require a more narrow tailoring of such a subpoena?
Might or might not. That's very fact-specific. It depends what the allegation of corruption is. Is it one lower-level judge accepting a bribe on one case? Then that you can narrow. Is it something systemic, like we saw in the New Hampshire not too many years ago, where there was questions on propriety in the Supreme Court. I think it was New Hampshire. I hope I'm not maligning New Hampshire unnecessarily or wrongly. But that kind of investigation is necessarily going to be much broader. And I would note also that, in closing, that this subpoena was directed to the custodian, so a legislator does not have to appear, does not have to look for records, and it does not detract from the legislative process. Thank you.
Well, I have a question for you. It seems to me that Washington talked about relevancy and said that in light of what the John Doe judge knows of the proceeding and the scope of the John Doe, the John Doe judge can decide relevancy without any additional showing by the government in a subpoena. Although it did say the better practice would be when the witness challenges relevancy for the John Doe judge to ask for an affidavit or materials. Now, I've tried to scan quickly the proceeding, and I didn't see any challenge to relevancy.
Correct.
I found a challenge to that there was too much and it's oppressive, but I didn't find a challenge to relevancy.
That is correct. I think I made the point earlier, yes.
I know that. But now what about Justice Sykes' question that how can you decide oppressive if you don't know relevance because you have to do a balance? But I'm not sure that that's the right question. Isn't it that you assume that it's relevant since it wasn't challenged, but that you have to balance the fact that it is relevant to this hearing against how much is being asked and how long it will take?
Yes, I think relevancy has essentially been conceded.
Now, you say that this subpoena, and I see it, it's handwritten in the subpoena, that gives an opportunity to do one thing or the other. Either you call these records or the judge was going to call them, even after you call, you being the,
yes,
the person who has them, has custody, the judge still will do that. But then there's been reference here that the judge says, come on back and tell us how you want this narrowed or how it can be narrowed, and I'll at least listen to it.
Yes. It's clear from the record that the judge is trying to accommodate the concerns of the LTSB on the quantity of the records and the scope of the subpoena. And as I've said before, investigators necessarily all too often have to work in the dark initially, and they have to ask for records they don't know what exactly is there or where it may lead. That's the nature of an investigation.
So assuming that, for the sake of argument, the court would say no privileges, no constitutional barriers, it would still have to go back to the trial, to the John Doe judge to, if the Bureau still contends it's too broad or takes too long, to go back to the trial judge and see what can be done about, I don't want to use the word narrowing, but at least accommodate the concerns about how much work there is by the Bureau.
Yes, I think the John Doe judge has indicated her willingness to do that. I would add, however, I think it's a little too late in the game for the Bureau to now claim that other things would not necessarily would be too broad or too burdensome. Those are arguments that should be made initially. They were given an opportunity by the judge to narrow it, to find something that would accommodate their concerns. They were uncooperative. The judge is still willing to do that, but at some point the records have to be produced, even if it may be inconvenient.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hankel, you have 5 minutes. Represent Judge Sarah O'Brien.
Yes, may it please the Court. Attorney Robert Hankel representing the Honorable Sarah O'Brien, one of the respondents. Very quickly, I want to emphasize, take up a bit on one of Justice Bradley's questions, and that is this particular petition concerns a question of whether the John Doe judge can be looking at some records in camera to determine a number of these other issues that I think we've leaped forward to consider. It is absolutely necessary that the judge have a position or the ability to determine questions like separation of power and overbreath by looking at what's involved. The judiciary or a judge has to make those decisions. It's part of the necessity of judicial review. The buck has to stop somewhere, and in this case, it's the judge. Referring to the nature of the John Doe proceeding itself, which is a proceeding to determine probable cause. There's probable cause hasn't been there determined yet, so that's the purpose of the proceeding. As stated in the Washington case, the John Doe judge has considerable latitude, has to have latitude, in proceeding with this investigative process, and has the responsibility of determining relevance and ensuring the fairness of the proceeding. And that is what she was doing, and that is what she would have continued to do in this particular instance with the in-camera review.
Counselor, if the only thing that's required for this subpoena is relevance, and if we agree with that proposition and say, okay, these records all have to be produced, what's to keep a civil action from being commenced by the Democrats against the Republicans or the Republicans against the Democrats for some alleged impropriety and, again, seeking the records from this agency? If we take the cap out of this bottle, don't we open it for an awful lot of circumstances?
No, not necessarily. In the primary instance, in this case, it's a John Doe proceeding, which is a secret proceeding. None of this material should get out into the public realm unless and until such time as criminal charges would be asserted and that those records would get out there. So that should not open any can of worms. And also these questions of privilege and confidentiality, those can be raised in later proceedings. And in fact, leaping around a bit, the judge, Justice Judge O'Brien, in her decision, and I'm trying to find in one of the transcripts, and I'm sorry I don't have, see the record, I think it's record 25, but in any event, at page 4 of the John Doe proceedings of November 15th, the judge clearly indicated the intention of notifying the legislators, the specific legislators involved, to afford them an opportunity to raise a privilege if that should be the case. The question is whether in this particular instance the Legislative Technological Service Bureau can prevent the judge from even looking at those records to determine whether we get to the next stage.
Was there some particular reason why the prosecutor didn't first try to get the records from the individual legislators, and then if they thought the submission was insufficient or lacking in some regard, go back for more authority?
I don't know that, because I believe that would be a prosecutorial tactic. You always look at what witness is most likely to give you what you want. There may be a variety of motivations that are concerned, availability, and a lot of other things I don't want to speculate about. But I think that you can use your imagination and come up with some easy reasons or some clear reasons why the prosecutor might have proceeded in this particular fashion.
Yeah, well, I can see it would be simpler for the prosecutor to describe one document. I mean, that doesn't take a lot of imagination to figure out from the prosecutor's point of view why he chose this particular document. I guess my concern is, in fairness to the legislators who are potentially going to be subject to criminal charges, is this the way we ought to be looking at proceeding?
I think it is, because I'll repeat that the John Doe judge anticipated affording the specific legislators an opportunity to assert a claim of confidentiality or privilege as that may or may not have been applied. And we're talking in a vacuum here. We don't know what these records are. What the judge ordered was that these records be produced. And I think rather ironically, she did afford Mr. Dykeman and his witness, Mr. Wall, an opportunity to go back and just produce certain records. And that was at the conclusion of a hearing at which Judge O'Brien made the determination that this was retrievable based upon the testimony of and the representation of Mr. Wall and Mr. Dykeman. That particular difficulty, it was apparent, at least she determined at the conclusion of that proceeding, could have been overcome based upon what the Technological Service Bureau, the Legislative Technological Service Bureau, actually represented to the court. But in any event, the somewhat odd thing about it is, if they didn't choose to do that, they give all the records to Justice O'Brien, and now she has the pleasure of going through all of these documents. Also, I don't believe in the transcript the arguments made that it's going to take months and months to get this information. I guess I find it a little hard to believe that we've got a technological entity like this that would take that long to come up with the information. I would suspect it probably would be quicker than that. But regardless of that...
Is that a guess, or do you know that as
a... No, I do not know that as a fact. That's a technological idiot advising to what I think would be the case. And I believe that if that had been presented to the judge, something else would have been fashioned.
Well, I asked that question, and others from the bench have asked just what is entailed, and I don't know if we've got a definite and certain answer on that yet.
And I don't know that one was in the record. I do know that, you know, there were several extended hearings on the matter, and there were opportunities for arguments to be made concerning overbreadth, and I do repeat Mr. Lee's position that relevance never was raised as a question, although, again, in the Washington case, that's up to the John Doe judge to determine that in any event. But the John Doe judge indicated and had flexibility. She was prepared to go with an in-camera review. That review was necessary to determine, is there some privilege that should be asserted here that's reasonably viable? Should the legislators be informed of this particular request for information? Is separation of powers implicated because of what's involved, or is it not implicated? Are there rules of proceedings, which, by the way, was half-heartedly raised in the lower court? The Judge O'Brien never even ruled on that issue, although there was a brief statement in one of the hearings that this would implicate the internal political process of the legislature by, I believe, Mr. Dykeman on November 15.
Let me interrupt for a minute. It's clear from what's been said and what appears in the record that the John Doe judge was troubled by the scope of this subpoena. Why should it have been the responsibility of the petitioner here to limit the subpoena? Why shouldn't the appropriate procedure have been for the John Doe judge to say, I'm going to quash the subpoena, Mr. Prosecutor, Ms. Prosecutor, whatever the case is, you come back to me with a narrowly tailored subpoena? Why isn't that the appropriate approach here?
That, I suppose that could have been an approach, but the fact is the judge may be short-circuited that by saying, Judge O'Brien, by saying, this is what you can do. And I don't know,
short-circuited.
By saying,
it's been going on a long time. It doesn't strike me it's been short-circuited.
Well, at that hearing, it hopefully would have been when Judge O'Brien said to the Legislative Technological Service Bureau, look, just give us the records that pertain to these specific individuals and these caucuses, produce those records, and I'll review those in camera. From what you've presented today, I conclude that you can do that. It doesn't appear to be a hopelessly impossible task. Do that and bring it in. The original subpoena itself, I think, has to be broad because, as Mr. Lee said, when you're engaged in an investigation, you don't know the specifics of what you're after. If you knew the specifics of what you're after, you probably had them already. What you're trying to do is to get to find out what in this block of material that is relevant evidence or is likely to lead to the discovery of relevant evidence is available. And the only way to do that, first, you take, okay, let's see what you've got. I'm not even certain that when that subpoena was first issued, until the time that the Legislative Technological Service Bureau made its presentation before Judge O'Brien, I'm not even certain whether the prosecutor knew what was entailed, whether it would be 26 boxes of tapes or whatever it would be. That's something that you issue the subpoena, and I think, as Mr. Lee said, the person subject to the subpoena says, wait, time out. This is too much. Look what's involved. It's oppressive. And the judge then sits there and says, okay, well, let's see what we can work out, and narrows the scope of that and did that. And as I said, even if that hadn't been narrowed, the individual that would be burdened with the task of reviewing this was Judge O'Brien, not anybody from the Legislative Technological Service Bureau. Unless there are any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hankel. Mr. Dykeman, you have a few moments in rebuttal.
Yes. I'd like to point out that the discussion about the overbroad and oppressive is fifth in our brief, the fifth prong, because we don't believe the court gets to it. I think it's necessary to read it to inform itself about the case. But this court does not have the jurisdiction, neither did the John Doe judge, to come into the legislative branch. The legislative branch has established this procedure. They have the authority to do so under Article 4, Section 8. And all the talk of how broad it was, which was extraordinarily broad, really isn't something that's reached. The legislature's power is plenary, unlike the U.S. Constitution, which has enumerated powers. I think any reference to federal case law is just misplaced. What the data said is you cannot obtain it from LTSB. Unstated is, can you get it from the member? The member, whether under subpoena or otherwise, will say, if they are directed to do so, they have the choice of directing LTSB to try to obtain it.
Counsel, we have before us an order for production for in-camera inspection. And this order asks LTSB to produce for in-camera review the backup tapes of apparently four people in two caucuses, I say apparently, or produce all of the tapes to the John Doe judge for in-camera inspection. You're asserting a privilege and asserting that it's absolute, but let me just assume hypothetically that this is not an absolute privilege. How long would it take you to produce the backup tapes to the pursuant to the order for production for in-camera inspection?
The first,
assuming you took the latter alternative and just give the judge the tapes.
The first way to do this is that you have to create a new server that doesn't exist now. You have to buy a server.
Maybe you didn't hear the last part of my question.
I'm sorry.
Assuming that you take the route of giving all of the backup tapes to the John Doe judge. I'm sorry if I interrupted
you.
I just wanted to make sure you heard that.
Okay. That, under the second provision, the custodian would have to go to the lockbox and get the tapes and walk over to the court. And
maybe 45 minutes?
Well, I don't know where they are, but a few hours. I mean, within a day, I would suspect that that's how long it would take, yes.
But that's what usually happens in discovery. You say, well, you come to the warehouse and you can look at everything. And, of course, the person who's told, come to the warehouse and look at everything, which happened to me once when I was practicing law, said, oh, good grief, no. I mean, I don't want to spend whatever amount of time it would take me to go through a warehouse of documents. So if it's so tough, let's get back to Justice Bradley's question. If it's so tough for you, it seems to me that's what you ought to do. Say, here's the warehouse.
Well, this isn't...
You look at it.
Your Honor, this isn't a normal warehouse. The Constitution...
Oh, I understand that. But how long would it take for the judge to go through this? All this material, or how long would it take for you if you're going to take the first alternative? That was your question.
On the first question, I don't believe she's capable of doing so. I don't believe they have the equipment.
Who's capable of doing it?
I am not.
Somebody in the state capable of
doing it? The LTSB is capable of doing it over time, yes.
How much time?
I started answering. The first step is to obtain a server. And that has to be bought, and it has to be a server that was in existence for the tape on December 15, 2001. You can buy them on eBay, maybe. You can buy them. It could take weeks. Then that server has to be configured, and it to accept the tapes. The software of December 15, 2001 has to be loaded on it. Then the tapes have to be loaded on it, and then they have to know which computer is needed. And it's not persons. You can't... Computers don't have names of people, they have numbers. So you have to pick...
Inventory, pick, though. You have an inventory of all the computers out there.
Yes, but not who's connected to them. And the judge would not let us even talk to the chief clerk to make any connection there. Okay, so then that process might take a month to get to that point. Then the person could maybe, within several days, do each computer backup. I don't know exactly, and it could go, depending how much is on the server, it could be a few days. I mean, I've heard that sometimes when a hard drive breaks, it might take a week for one hard drive.
You've taken the route of eBay and delivery, so that takes you a month. For me, how many person hours is this going to take? Now, I know you can't answer it, but to say it's going to take a month to get off the ground in your hypothetical, how, and then you said once you get off the ground, then it's going to take a couple days. Is it going to take of actual work, not waiting for it and getting the server? And I mean, how much actual work? A couple days, a couple weeks of actual work?
Setting up a server is actual work. Loading the software is actual work.
Okay. How
so
much actual work?
Several months. For, depending on how many people you want. And they were not precise on how many people. And you first have to decide on the people connected to the computers. And we don't have that knowledge.
Are you in a better position than the district attorney or the judge to raise the appropriate questions of, is this what you want? Is that what you want? And tell them how much time it would take?
LTSB, the best I can say is that when somebody's hard drive breaks or they synchronize a Palm Pilot, they have a two-way conversation for quite a while to decide to narrow it and so forth.
But if a legislator asked it, you could do it.
Pretty much, yes. And LTSB would do it at the request of a legislator, whether the legislator was subpoenaed, directed to do it by court order, or on their own behalf.
You would do it for a legislature because you're a service bureau. You give service
to the legislator. Yes.
Right?
Yes. We would try to do it, certainly.
Okay. So if you could try and do it for a legislature, you could try and do it here, even though it raises all sorts of technical problems. And it raises all sorts of issues about how many people are involved and which computer, et cetera. But you try and do the best you could if it were a legislator asking for this.
Yes, Your Honor, we'd try to do the best, but there is certainly the Constitution and the statute stopping it.
And that's why that's your main argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
Not
that's
the oppressive.
And that's
not
why we.
Technology,
I don't.
Technology, not all that.
That's why I believe we don't get to that. Your Honor.
The process that you just described in detail about what would be required to actually open up and look at and cull through these tapes for relevant information, is that what the John Doe judge would be required to do if you just turned them all over?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's why I said I don't believe she's capable of doing it, and I don't believe she has the equipment. It's not, you don't put them on a regular computer, and they cannot be read by a regular computer. It's not a DVD or anything like that. When a legislator asked for it, all these steps have to go through, and they put the data onto a DVD and give it to the legislator. But it's a much more involved process than anybody knows, and I've talked to the people who've done it.
And she can't very well rely on investigative staff if this is to be an in-camera review, right?
She cannot. I believe the Department of Justice has this capability, and I do not believe that this court has this capability, except for possibly your IT person.
Okay, so
I don't know.
A staff would have to be hired to do this.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it couldn't be Mr. Feist's staff or Mr. Blanchard's staff or the DOJ staff.
That is for sure. The violation occurs whether it is the Attorney General getting the tapes or the John Doe judge. And also the record does not describe what happened and the position of the John Doe judge as it's being discussed here. I think you have to look at the record. It is not that clear as others have stated. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your argument, which has, I think, been enlightening to the court about the procedure and your constitutional argument. And thank you, Mr. Lee and Mr. Hankel, for your arguments on the law and the facts, which also has been very helpful to the court. But that will conclude our hearing in 02-3063W. custodian of records for the Legislative Technology Services Bureau versus the State of Wisconsin. The court will take a few moments in recess, so counsel and the students may leave the courtroom and additional students will come in. So we are in recess for a few moments. Thank you.